Welcome to Culture Chats, an accessible discussion intertwining cultural and social issues while delving into the minds of some of the leading contemporary voices in Irish culture. Today I will be hosting a discussion focusing on performance and spectacle with an exciting lineup of artists who, whether it be through song, the written word or visuals, have contributed significantly to contemporary Irish culture in recent years. Their work often brings political and personal and social issues to the fore, and we will discuss themes of performative responsibility, activity and artistry. On today's episode, we feature Erica Cody, a singer, songwriter and producer, Felly Speaks, a poet, performer and playwright, Macer, a contemporary visual artist, Tara Stewart, a DJ and broadcaster on RT2FM, and James Vincent McMorrow, a platinum-selling singer and songwriter. I'm Matthew Nevin, co-director of the Mark Gallery and Studios, and also CICLA, the Contemporary Irish Arts Centre, Los Angeles. I work as a curator, filmmaker and artist, and have worked in some big projects and many little ones. I want to bring my experience and the experience of others together to build a better future for our culture. Thanks so much for coming. I was going to pick on you first, James, and ask you about what, it's a simple question but a hard one, what brought you to be a musician and to led you down the road of where you are today. What was the thing that started you on that journey?
I actually couldn't give you an answer that's under 40 minutes. No, honestly, like, I don't, like, I mean, but I could give you a really simplistic answer and say that, like, it was the only thing that I was ever good at. I had a lot of belief in myself when I was, like, 15, 16. I was just like, fuck all these. I was in other bands and everyone was shit. And I just remember thinking, like, I am shit, but I'm smart enough at this age to realize that I'm crap at this, but I think I could be good. Whereas everybody else that I was in bands with were like they would be like, what are we going to do when where are we going to put our Grammys? You know, they would just like talk like it was success was a foregone conclusion. And I just woke up every morning thinking about music in this very like real sense, which I don't think a lot of my peers as kids were doing. And that felt different enough to pursue. So I just pursued it. And then it was just like a really steady jog up a hill. My parents were kind of like good for it. Like they're pretty self-made people and pretty wild individuals. And they were just like, do whatever makes you happy. And they gave me enough slack to kind of like stay within the margins. They were like, as long as you keep achieving stuff, but not in like a arbitrary way, then, you know, we'll keep supporting you like as best we can as humans. And it just, so a lot of things aligned to make it happen, but I just never looked at other jobs as being like any more or less worthy than being in the arts. Yeah. You know, like I've friends that are, you know, accountants and lawyers, and I don't give a shit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and yeah. I have accountants and lawyers, and I don't talk to them like they have some hallowed ground higher than me.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. I just always just went, art is worthy of everything. So like, just pursue it. Like everyone pursues these jobs, the same kind of tirelessness.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point about the vocation, and I don't know about yourselves, but I always feel sometimes, I suppose, defending your choices and what you've become, and trying to not slag off what someone else has become and having respect and having equality in that way.
Like, when I was in school, for example, I wasn't around people who were like-minded, so I felt I was trying to, you know, I'd be making excuses for wanting to be a musician. It wasn't just, because it wasn't the norm. It was like, I wasn't studying to become a lawyer or I'd love to be a vet, but I just knew it wasn't my calling. So I think when you're used to being around in that environment and then being in the industry and exposed to people who are like-minded, it kind of makes you think that you're not crazy for doing what you love. Yeah. And luckily for me, I had two parents who did things that they loved all the time now, and they were happy. You know, it wasn't about, you know, making the most money and being this successful. It was just about being content and doing what nurtures you, and not just doing something for the sake of doing it or for the wrong reasons. So I think I always kind of carried that with me.
When do you, because we all get jaded, it's like, you've made that choice, you work really hard,
yeah.
And then you're kind of like questioning that choice, going, oh my God, what have I done? Was this the right choice? And then you go, maybe I should have been a vet. What am I doing? Or can I still be a vet? Like,
you probably come to those places when you're at your biggest struggle, or you can't, like, I've been in situations where I was not paying my rent and I was couch surfing, and you'd have to then adhere to the system a little bit to use your skill set, your creative skill set, to apply it to a more 9-to-5 job. And I've dabbled my toe in that, and I did some little things, and it wasn't really rewarding, you know. And because I always probably knew that there was you could carve some sort of other better option.
Come closer. Come closer. Cave into this command, comrade. Come take a closer look at my browning, brittle branches. Come see how much of us can be broken and bulldozed. Don't bury your shame. Come, shake my leaves for gathering, bask in their fall, crisp to heavy feet. For you, autumn, ought to be grateful, glad, joyous for the shade of the mighty oak. History retells, we cannot be tender, pen knives cut through coats.
This is the thing about the longevity of anyone's career, and we see it of like, when do you decide, and I see it, I was only talking about a performance artist to Kira the other day about a really, like, he was quite successful, a young guy, and then suddenly he's gone, but he's gone into some other career, and you're just like, oh yeah, he obviously just reached that point of like, oh no, this isn't right for me. Have you reached that point?
I don't think I ever hit the point where I didn't think it was right for me. I just hit moments where, am I going to eat though? Am I going to eat this month?
Yeah.
I've had those points.
Yeah.
And I think I took a hard look at myself and decided if it was worth the risk, and also tried as much as possible to make sure that the leap wouldn't be too painful when I do land, wherever I do land, that like I'm sure that I'm making the right decision. And I suppose the only way I try to soothe myself by making sure I'm making the right decision was like I try to go to college for it. And not even like creative writing. I was like, no, okay, I can do the writing thing. I just know I need to know how to sell this.
Yeah.
And like just the idea that like, okay, I have something that could be worth selling. It's just I understand enough about society that this is such a niche and weird thing to endeavor and try and do, or I'm going to be a poet.
Yeah,
you know, like, and eat what for breakfast?
Yeah. It's the professional development, I think,
yeah,
that we talk about it a lot here of like, who is your boss? Who is your own master? Who's making your decisions? And a lot of times it's yourself. You might work with other people who might help you get in your journey. Do you want to talk a bit about your journey and how you've, I suppose, managed your own career? Like, I think it's been obviously quite very successful, but I'm sure it's come with a lot of hardships, and it might be nice to hear.
It's funny, both my parents are quite academic, so they're not creative kind of people at all, but they always wanted to be very creative, so they were really encouraging for me to do music and art and all that kind of stuff. And so, funnily enough, when I finished high school, I actually really wanted to be a lawyer, and so I started working as a judge's associate in the local courthouse. It wasn't that hard to get a job, so it's not that impressive. And so I worked there for like 2 years, and I really, really loved it, but I hated my town, Alice Springs. I just couldn't live there anymore, so I decided to move and actually originally be a musician. I really wanted to do that. To be honest, it was more so like, and my dad is going to listen to this because he's a big supporter of mine, but it was more so he really wanted me to pursue being a musician. I had a huge love for music, but I didn't know if I particularly wanted to be a musician. And then eventually when I was around, I actually moved to Ireland when I was 20, was working in restaurants and cafes, playing music, and then I just kind of fell out of love with performing. And then one day I genuinely just saw a tweet that said their radio station was looking for fill-in radio presenters. And I was like, oh yeah, like I have a nice like speaking voice, I thought at the time, the confidence. And I thought, yeah, I'll apply. And I applied and I didn't get it, obviously. Like I'm trying to find the demo because I'm sure it's absolutely awful. But I just recorded it in my room, in my wardrobe. But from that, then I still was like, I actually really would like to get into radio, but I didn't really know where to start. I literally listened. I think I just like copied a BBC News report. Like that was it, which wasn't what I actually wanted to get into. Like I didn't want to get into that type of radio. So I got into radio kind of just through sending in demos, and eventually got into kind of like a small kind of training station. And from there, you know, I was lucky to have a couple of presenters that thought there was some talent in me and decided to kind of help nurture me, because I didn't really have anyone to kind of go to listen to, say, demos that I'd created or whatever. And then from there, I sent in demos to RTE, got a show on their digital stations, which was 2XM, which again is another kind of training station and to develop talent or whatever. I mean, I started in radio, I think, around four to five years ago, which feels crazy now. But yeah, so I sent in lots of demos, got asked lots of people to listen to my stuff. That's kind of how I eventually got to where I am now. But I've done it, like, you know, I was doing news reporting, I was doing cover of people's show, doing early shifts, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
I wanted to talk a bit about, I'm kind of jumping a bit here, about what forms your creativity. And I suppose Ireland can be a really positive and enlightening place and really creative, and we're really known, and I spend a lot of time like bringing artists around the world, doing exhibitions and providing opportunities, and I think internationally we have such a good name. But what makes you create your work? Or what kind of, is it driven by a social issue? Is it driven by personal issues?
Definitely the start of the pandemic last year, I was like, well, life isn't happening. I have nothing to write about. I feel so uninspired. I'm stuck in my room. These four walls, like, get me out. Like, I get inspired by just getting on a bus and going into town or meeting someone or just life. And then there was just so many things going on in terms of the world and what was happening, from Black Lives Matter all the way up to just being a woman in 2020. It was just, it was a heavy year.
Yeah.
So I think you need, well, I needed to take that time to just be present and just know that I'll be creative again at the right time. But there was, I felt like focus was just shifted. Like, I wrote one song that was about a struggle, like a social struggle. Mm. But I don't necessarily go into any room with that mindset of like, oh, I'm going to write about this today or this today. Like, that's what I love about the creative process. It changes all the time, and it can be inspired by absolutely anything. It could be inspired by that chair.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, going around in
circles.
And
I suppose it's that pressure that, like, that comes with being an artist, of like trying to create. And do you find that, Al or Felicia, that of like, well, oh, now I have to, are you like, if you have a show coming up, you're like, I need to now go and fucking produce something, or...
Yeah, this pressure's there. So you have to, I guess, just your experience to know when that is and what things you put in place to sort of nurture and facilitate that part of your brain to open and get kick-started, and what would be the things that would hinder that, you know. So the obvious ones I'm always preaching about is meditation and sort of well-being would definitely help my mindset more, which give me clearer thoughts, help me sleep better, I won't be as naggy, I'll be able to manage life. Always tries to get in on top of you're trying to create headspace constantly to get that flow in your brain, and life will do everything it can to sort of get into that space. So it's just putting these, practicing discipline and boundaries and all these things. So I've got a show, two shows, one is later in the year, but already they're 4 months away. I'm putting the things in place now. What are the things that are going to stop me from getting to that space? So preparation, and you know, I always make these silly sort of comparisons to artists being like athletes, but like, you have to sort of sacrifice yourself to your discipline. And what's that? Is that early nights? Does that mean I'm not going to go for pints on a Friday and roll into the Saturday, whatever it is? And because that will, you know, I won't do what I need to do on Monday, and then I'll inherently be upset. And all this, so it's trying to just alleviate all this pressures. But the biggest struggle is just the balance of life and art. And as you were referencing earlier about, you know, creating art, I don't know, it's so intertwined in you. That, like, you know, we're sitting here right now, but I still have about a file of facts of 15 things that I need to do and do to stop Saturday being a pressure of Sunday, to, because in September the 18th, I need to be present in that moment.
Yeah.
And I won't change that. Like, I'm happy to take on that burden, if you'd want to call it a burden, because the reward of having purpose and, you know, fought so hard to be here, to enjoy this, that, like, if that's all I got to moan about, that's all right.
You know what I mean? And Felicia, I suppose your practice obviously is built around words and your voice. And what pressure comes with that? That you're obviously so conscious of what I'm going to say is everyone, like, this is your opinion. This is what, this is the words coming out of your mouth. This is what I'm reading. And they're interpreting that. That's a lot of pressure. And how do you manage that?
It's pretty hard, I'd say, actually. I didn't think it would be as hard as it feels. But the balancing, like Al mentioned, it is about balancing life. But most of all, whenever I do feel pressure to use my words beyond the space in the poem, like, because usually I'm the kind of artist that whatever I need to say, I've put in the poem, usually. And then we can have a conversation around it, but realistically, I've already said everything I need to say. So oftentimes getting into spaces where suddenly your voice is required outside, like even now I'm like, oh my God, your voice is required outside of the profession that you said, this is what I do. You know, and it only really happens, especially when, like, the kind of writer I am, I write about a lot of social issues and identity and society. So obviously it's things to discuss, but you kind of get like, I kind of get surprised nearly, like, oh, now we have to chat about it. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and what about, like, and this is open to anyone, is that when you are involved in talking about society or social issues, are to be up with all that pressure of, like, you, if someone's bringing up a story or, like, referencing stuff, you always kind of have to be on the ball and kind of going. Yeah. Because, and they also, I suppose, sometimes might idolise the words or the performance or whatever you've said. Mm-hmm. Like, dealing with that pressure is obviously difficult.
Yeah. We're not all just grouped where, If a situation happens where you're held, you're a voice of that. Like, you know, you, again, it's boundaries thing, because you do feel it's a guilt culture. And we were talking about to say no to a project or whatever. You know, you have to, because if you do that, well, then you'll actually lose your own voice and you lose your time, and then you're just a puppet for. You know, geez, imagine trying to keep up when you find the things that you are passionate about, because we all are. You really focus yourself on that and you give it your all, like, you know, rather than sort of diluting yourself a little bit.
So I also wanted to talk about creative spaces and I suppose the scene in Dublin and in Ireland. So many venues have closed over the last 10 years. We obviously fight to try to stay open. What do you think, or what do you see Dublin and Ireland's going to be like in 5 years?
I have a huge amount of faith in the people, and I have a huge amount of faith in the arts to figure it out. Like I was saying to you earlier, like if you give me a euro and tell me to figure it out, I'll figure it out, because my career started with nothing and you just build it up. And like you were talking about, like, how are you going to eat? Like everybody in this room, I imagine, has had that feeling, because you have to be like a perpetual motion machine for your own career. No one is asking or has ever asked the government in this country for anything meaningful. Like, you know, we're not like, give us this block of money and we'll do this. It's like, give us the bare minimum and we'll figure it out for you. And the government does what they think is a lot, but it's the bare minimum. Mm. It's not just about giving people MISP grants. It's about saying, like, we appreciate the value of that place there and we're going to protect it. So if some company wants to come in and turn it into a co-living space, we're going to stop them. Mm. That's all it takes. It's that might sound like a lot to someone. Maybe whoever is in the co-living, like, industry. Is in that job, like, that's their thing. They probably have an issue with me saying that. But, like, I just think that there's a balance and there's a nuance to it. It's not a binary structure. Like, there's a way to do it that protects those institutions that we've all grown up around.
I mean, I would agree with James. I mean, I moved here in, like, 2011, and so... And then I just remember in that, like, first four years that I was living here, I was meeting so many new people, trying to figure out who I wanted to be, you know, figure out what kind of scene I wanted to be in, what friends I wanted to be with. And I became friends with loads of creative people, and they were all, like you said, doing what they could with the resources that they had at the time. But you had really cool spaces. You had, like, Block T, you had Jigsaw, and all these. And so you'd be going to, like, markets and all these. And at those things, I'm not saying, like, oh, yeah, cute market, get to buy myself some cute earrings or whatever. But you get to, like, interact with people, meet people, network with people. That's how I've met all my friends, like, is through going to these really cool kind of events and social gatherings and connecting with people that are like-minded to me. And I live in Portobello, and I'm always devastated every time I walk by the Bernard Shaw, just looking at it, and then with this towering, I mean, you know, it's near your studio, and this towering building behind it. And I absolutely love the Bernard Shaw. It's another place where I met, and it's not just a bar, it's a place where so many people have met. You know, it's so much more than that.
I remember having a conversation with a guy who was not in the arts and just referenced people who work in the arts and culture kind of like their own little bubble, and like that you're really kind of a privileged life, no matter if you're on the dole or you're making 80 grand a year.
Everybody,
right?
Mad as you say this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, what so else is
like,
about us?
How do you transform, how do you get, I suppose, our problems across to that person who thinks, well, everything you've just said is not a problem.
Last year, when everything came unstuck, I remember there was an article about the music industry, I think, and it was like in terms of like ticket sales and how much that contributed to the exchequer, and it wasn't a huge number. It was like 50 million or maybe something like, but it was like, so it's a big number, but all these other industries were like, we're losing billions.
Yeah.
And I remember how like hilariously honest it was, and thinking, why the fuck would you be so honest? Like for every one ticket that gets sold, how many drinks get sold and how much food gets sold before people go to those shows, and how many jobs are created. And like, so for every one thing that you do, every one piece of art or one piece of culture that everyone in this room or beyond contributes to society, what's the economic value of it? Like the idea that this is a privileged like little bubble is the most ludicrous thing.
I think the irony of presuming we're privileged when the least on our requirement list is a place to gather. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, to think we are privileged because we're requesting a place that we can interact and collaborate enough to create art that you enjoy for leisure is really strange. I don't know. I just think that we've done enough in the advocating for self. I think we couldn't possibly do more than we've already done so far. And I keep thinking that should the responsibility fall on artists to keep having artist blackouts? Like, is that enough to get attention? Is that enough to get advocacy? I hope something else steps up, because I don't have the answer for it. But I just know that I think we've done enough, in my opinion. And I think the pressure to do more than we're already doing is crippling, and I think would add more to the crippling of our creativity in general.
You have the National Campaign for the Arts doing some campaigns, and they're, I think, a voluntary-run organisation, and we put a big, massive banner in the middle of COVID, fighting for the arts outside of here, and then you obviously have the Department of Culture and you have the Arts Council, and I always talk to the Arts Council, do so much, like they're effectively just a grant-giving agency. Why aren't they more of a voice for the artists? That they're are like, they've now moved a bit more into kind of professional development and funding kind of stuff, but why aren't they a symbol for like protecting the arts and advocating for the arts? What do you guys think?
Well, I've had no experience with getting funding from anyone, so I can't really. Just because, like, I'm a practical artist, so in terms of grant applications and the errors and that's like that, my brain's just not wired for that.
Yeah.
So it's easier for me. I've applied and unsuccessfully applied, but I'm not upset by that because I use my discipline to. I'd rather put my energy into my craft and be able to fund it that way, and that's quite rewarding. The sustainable aspect of it, like, but just referencing what you're saying there about the mindset of that guy you're talking to, what I've sort of learned is the language used and sort of it's still carried through is like, and I speak from visual arts, it's like a hobby still, and so with that then there's, oh, that's not a real career, so that's a luxury, you know, and and then when someone doesn't see the value in it, that's because it doesn't pay a part in their life. And so you just need to ask, find out what those important things are in that person's life. Maybe it's rugby, and you just remove rugby from their life, and maybe they'd see that, okay, that is essential.
That's so great. That's a really good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, so it's quite like per person as well. And and judgment usually comes like that from just literally lack of self-awareness and knowledge of something. That's usually when I get feedback off someone, I'm usually going, this is... just you don't have a clue.
things I wanted to talk about was performance and the idea of what performance means to you. So you all obviously work in different disciplines or some similar, and it takes a lot to perform, whether you're like sitting in front of a microphone or you're presenting work to people. And how do you, I suppose, deal with the anxieties that come with performance? And Erica, how is it for you, or how do you prep yourself and like deal with that, whether it's even making a video? And obviously, now that you haven't been on a stage for I don't know how long, how are you feeling about going back to that?
Yeah, it's mad. Like, I did a gig a couple of, like, last week, and it was just in, like, an empty auditorium. And it was so crazy because, as a musician, that, like, the live side of getting to, well, getting to perform your music live that you've probably made in your bedroom or in your studio or vice versa, it's like a whole new sort of expression for me anyway. Like, when I'm on stage, I feel totally unapologetically myself, you know. It's kind of just like me there, world out, you know. It's a thing that really keeps me going. So it's been weird having to adjust my performance, I suppose, to being just performance on my own and performing for myself, having to record even remotely, like recording everything from my home studio instead of being in a studio. And maybe so I might do a little run and someone will be like, oh yeah, just that little, you know, just yeah, that little bit of human connection, I suppose, is, it's really missed. But
and social media, obviously, like you're popular in social media. How does that work into your practice? And what, I suppose, element of yourself or your true self do you present in that and on stage compared to the Erica sitting down writing something?
How I manage social media anyway is that I know that it's not all real. So I always, I suppose, I try and put my... We always, as humans, we like to put our best selves forward all the time. You know, I think naturally we like to celebrate our wins more than our losses, when our losses kind of make us who we are, essentially. So social media for me is just a bit of a wormhole, because I felt like at one stage I had imposter syndrome. The second, I was getting attacked. The third was like, but I just want to make music and put it out there. So I still feel like I'm trying to find that happy medium between, because like I started out by doing like covers on YouTube and just posting them, and I wasn't confident at all back then, to now see myself kind of, I suppose, dissecting myself in a way where I'm like, oh, I kind of find I go back to 15, 16 year old Erica sometimes, because at that age I was in school and I wasn't around people who were like-minded like me and wanted to express themselves, whether it was, you know, just making a video and putting it online. Yep. So there was a lot of, oh, you think you're great doing that and you're getting praise for it, you know, instead of just it being celebrated. So I things like that stick with you from a very, I suppose I was at a very impressionable age where I cared what people thought of me and I cared about people's opinions, and it's only now that I'm starting to give less fucks, I suppose, about what people think of me and what I wear and what I do and where I go and how I present myself online, you know.
All that and like, I suppose, what we all give of ourselves in our art opens up this wormhole or like opportunity for someone who doesn't know you to have an opinion on you. And
yeah,
dealing with that in the real world versus social media is so different. And like,
that's the one big thing I struggled with, because I noticed people online, when I went through a phase of just being heavily trolled, was that music for me was always a way for me to express myself. It was my therapy. It was always cathartic. I used to play basketball. Basketball was my outlet. Whereas music was that thing that always stuck with me throughout everything. And I knew it was always something that I didn't want to be something of the past. That's, it would be something with me throughout my whole life. I never minded the maybe criticisms or opinions that I get on my music. If it's not for you, that's absolutely fine. But I do it for myself first and foremost. And hopefully somebody else can relate if they're struggling through something and can take something from it. But when social media came into it with music and people thought they knew me and my character, and when my character was becoming this thing of, oh, but she's not really like that. And it's like, but I know who I am. And then I think when you start, there's already enough self-doubt, I think, as a creative and as a musician, that when social media plays a part in it, it can just pick you apart. I started picking myself apart to the point that I didn't even recognise myself. I wouldn't leave the house. It was this whole thing. So I kind of had to bring myself totally back to basics, do the things that I enjoy and that I love, whether it's sitting on my laptop playing Sims for 5 fucking hours or something, do you know what I mean? Or just going for a walk, or things that I don't get to do on the daily because I just want to create and I want to make art and I want to be in a venue and I want to be around people and I want to collaborate and I want to do all these things, but it's not fucking possible.
Mm. Shame on people who cast judgment. Like, you know, you're allowed to have an opinion, but there's definitely been a culture in the last year on social media to really like casting judgment. And when I would, we all do that for sure, but once you learn to practice the ability to sort of have the awareness that, oh, I'm casting judgment here on this person because maybe they're... Because a lot of people are doing new creative things and they're nurturing parts of their life that are, and a lot of judgment with that. So I would just always sort of self-evaluate that. And then usually when you get to the crux of it, you're like, that's because I have this fault of myself. Like, so I just, when I hear that, like, that would upset me a little bit to hear that. But know that that's obviously their issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you use some of that experience or whatever to help, obviously, so other artists?
I would manage myself then with that. Would be like, well, what does that person deserve? Because I was very, social media is new to me. I came from both sides of pre-internet and now. And so I was very generous with everything I gave. And then I just sort of went, well, maybe people don't really deserve that so much. So I pulled back. And it made me sort of just be a little bit more present, because it just wasn't really helping my artwork. And I think that I was getting quite muddled up to like Al and Macer on social media and all that sort of shit. So you just sort of share what you want. But in terms of like going from huge projects in Sydney where there's containers being shipped in to, you know, just delegate the shit out of everything. Like, the more, like, I get overwhelmed all the time. There's always a week or so where I'm like, whew, like this morning, I'm like,
absolutely,
oh my God, there's so much. So then I go, I have to filter and review. And downtime is so essential for clarity. And downtime can be 20 minutes meditating in the morning or journaling. That'll help you just sort of sit with yourself and figure out to just... there's no real answer because everything will change.
Yeah, and I think it's funny how like the amount of pressure we put on ourselves, especially within a day, and you're like, I'm going to do all this, and then you're like, oh my God, I've done nothing, or
you do a list format for the week, and then you don't, you think you're going to achieve it, and then you don't, so then you beat yourself up because you haven't achieved it. So empathy, you have to just keep like, you know, practice it yourself. And then something I was always looking forward, and I would be very, very ambitious and self-driven, but then not sort of taking a moment to sort of rewarding yourself a little bit. So I've done a lot of that over the last few months to be like, oh, you set this real high task for yourself and then you achieved it. Okay, like fair play, like, you know, rather than on to the next. But you have to be like, again, so we're talking about pre-internet and things. I come from a place where you have to, my younger me was man up, you know, this conversation of man up and be this, and no one's going to save you, there's no Calvary coming to save you. And then also now I live in a world of, that wasn't too good for me at times, so now practice empathy. And so I live in this nice balance of being very, very driven, but have the awareness to sort of go, you're overextending yourself now, well, chill out, you're not giving enough time to your family, which, you know, all these sort of things.
I suppose you try, at the moment I'm speaking for yourself now, but I see you trying to help other generations and other people of different ages or whatever who might be emerging into starting a career like yourself. What's the biggest thing you're trying to do for them or help them?
The whole sort of integrated lifestyle thing that I can show you, like I don't need to show you how to paint because you got that, but to paint your best and make the space, like, usually there's boundaries that are stopping them from succeeding, whatever success is to them. And it's down to just a narrative in their head. So it might be, I'm speaking in general, but it could be like low self-esteem or inner voice, or it could be simple boundary, like, I can't do this. And if you give them the tools, it might be fundamentally, I don't have a website to be, like, so sort of just giving them the shortcuts and understand that creative isn't sitting there and you dip into it whenever. It's totally a part of you, what you do in your lifestyles.
Yeah. And Felicia, what's your biggest challenge in the creative process then, in this, as you prepare yourself to I always think it must be really daunting for someone who, like for all of us, like a musician or a poet, where you're putting these words down and you're imagining yourself maybe performing them, that how much pressure and how do you deal with that creative process and you're in the development and how do you deal with the actual in front of camera, standing on stage, like you've been so successful lately, like how have you been managing that?
Okay, you asked 5 questions.
Yeah. And answer them all very good, okay?
Just segment them all, yeah. Matthew.
Yeah.
But in terms of like, okay, the first one, how do I manage the going on stage and that creative process? I do a lot of internal screaming. I do a lot of breath work. I'm being really honest. People think, like, especially when you get on stage and you're confident or you appear confident and you've trained your voice enough, and I'm sure musicians can agree, where you don't sound shaky. They don't see your foot moving. And I think the thing is, just before I get on stage, I make sure to center myself, to have a little chat with Felicia, like, you're a bad bitch, you got this, you know, God loves you, you love you. Really cheering yourself on, because you especially with when you get into the industry part, when you get from artist space to industry space, see how I swear?
Yeah.
industry space, you start feeling a little bit more like a product than a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only way to combat that is to give yourself that grace to make sure that you're looking after yourself, you're thinking about yourself, you're making sure you had your coffee, you had enough hours between your coffee before you got on stage so you're not vibrating. Like, it's the intentionality of self-care while you're creating and while you're doing work, and knowing that you need it. I had to learn that the hard way.
Yeah.
Knowing that, like, maybe I actually do need people to leave me the heck alone 20 minutes before I get on stage. And I have to be really firm about that and not grin in their face when I haven't calmed my voices down yet, you know? And that can be quite difficult as well, learning how to navigate multiple creative spaces outside of your workroom, you know,
mm-hmm.
because that you also have a stake in that space before you go on stage. You have a stake in the space of the meeting room before you go on stage, you know, and learning that you own multiple moments before the stage. It took me a while to get from, okay, I'm the writer, and I'm also the performer, but learning that, like, I'm the writer in the meeting room, I'm the writer that's advocating for myself, I'm the writer that's sending the invoice, there's so many moments of work, and so there's many moments for self-care. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it's beautifully said, yeah, and I love that idea of owning the moments before you go on stage. I wanted to ask you, James, that how have you dealt with wellness and mindfulness, I suppose, of over your career in dealing with that, or do you... Has anything changed in how you develop and prepare to perform?
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to think that, like, the next time I step foot on stage that I will approach it differently.
Yeah.
Because I think that this last year has made me realize just maybe I've been quite hard on myself. Like, my work ethic has probably been, like, the thing that I've prided myself on most, which is weird because the music is the thing that has given me this life. But, like, my work ethic... And my sort of determination was always the thing that I kind of prided myself on. So, like, I've been quite aggressively tough on myself as a tourer, to just, like, give it every night and to play do everything and figure it out. So, like I think we did, like, 800 shows and I never cancelled one. It was some weird statistic.
Yeah.
Like, I could remember crazy stuff, like, when things started taking off for me here in Ireland in, like, 2011, I was headlining the tent in Galway. And I woke up that morning and I couldn't move. I was completely dead. I was just throwing up constantly. It was a nightmare. And the tour bus pulled up outside the house. I was living in Mespel Place at the time. And the tour bus pulled up outside the house and everyone got off. And I was, like, looking at all these faces. And we were supposed to do that and then go to, like, Cambridge to do the folk festival or something the next day. So... The bus was supposed to, and I was looking at it going, there's so much money on the line, and like for me and for all these people, but their livelihoods and their well-being. So I got my dad to come into town and drive me to a doctor in Malahide because that's where I grew up. So that's where my doctor was.
Yeah.
My doctor jammed a bunch of needles in my arm. I passed out. I fell asleep in the back of my dad's car and he drove me to Galway. Well, the bus went ahead of me, and I arrived at like 8:15, and like Lisa Hanning was opening. I remember she like came off stage, and she was like, "You look like you're gonna die," and I was like, "I might. This could go either way." But I remember doing the show, and there was like I had to run off stage from time to time, like throw up, all this crazy shit. But I remember getting off stage, going, "I did it." Like, I did it. It didn't matter if the show was good or bad. Yeah. I never want to see. But thank God it was going, because, like, has anyone been in that tent? It's so lit. It's so loud. And, like, I may as well have not been there. It was amazing, because, like, of all the shows. But I remember getting off the stage and thinking, like, that's what I'm supposed to do. Like, look how I came through for everybody. But no one's giving you a medal for it. And all you're doing is, like, kind of grinding yourself into the ground. So, like, for, like, 10 years, I've definitely been on a track of, like, that mentality. And I'm excited to be more holistic in my perspective and to be kinder to myself. Exactly what you said. Like, just, like, to allow myself the possibility, not of failure, but of fragility, for sure. And, like, to go into it with a different mindset. Because I've just always been that. That's my thing. Like, and I've sort of propped up situations around me to a ridiculous degree to kind of keep the show on the road. But it's not about that. It's about, like, your own mental health has been... In the recesses of my mind, like I had a pretty debilitating eating disorder when I was a kid, and then music replaced that as like my, I guess in hindsight, my control mechanism. Right? So this year has brought that to bear for me, where I'm like, oh my gosh, how have I gone through like 15 years of not having like an eating disorder that has manifested itself in a real world scenario? But the control issues that came with it, sort of flipping into music and then me driving this train up a hill. And then like this last year of reflection going, oh my God, like this whole time it's been there, but it just changed lanes. It just became this thing where I was like, look what I can control. So I controlled the outcome that day, and people were excited because they got to see a show, and everyone was excited that worked for me because they all got paid. But like, what's the worth? Like, the worth is not that. The worth is something deeper. It's like being a well-rounded person. So I'm excited to be a well-rounded person for the first time in my adult life and get on stage and see what happens. I think it's going to be...
Did you say the word fragility?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that word. Yeah. And I think when you mentioned that you felt like your work ethic was something that you were most proud of before the music, I felt like I resonated. I was like, bing! Because, like, and I think it's the...
You said it as well earlier, your work ethic, like, the work.
The work ethic.
The work you sacrifice.
Exactly. And I think it links to what you mentioned earlier about having to prove that this is worth doing.
Yeah.
And that idea that, like, if I don't keep working, this might casually crumble around me. But also just, like, realizing that you are not a work meal. For some reason, I don't know why, but artists get into this space where you are just... going at the expense of self just to keep other things in place.
Yep.
And I love the word fragility, like, because it's linked to vulnerability and the idea that you are not like Superman or Superwoman in this beautiful, magical, weird thing that you're doing, because creativity often looks like a spell, like magic. And so this amazing thing that you're wielding, you need to take care of the vessel that brings it forth. That makes sense. Sorry, I'm sounding really poetic. Brings it forth.
I love it.
But yeah.
No, that's great. I was just going to ask you, what allowed you to change, like obviously the pandemic, but what allowed you to, what's allowing you to feel the way you're feeling now? Do you think it was just the space and the time? Was it something else?
I think it was the space and the time. Yeah. Like, you're defined by your work. I think, like what you just said, that like, if you work in an office space, the jealousy I felt in this last year of friends of mine that were working in these like jobs that I don't know anything about, but I know that they wake up in the morning, they work until from 8 until 5 or whatever.
Yeah.
like it's just like, sounds so overtly like someone that's never had a regular job in my entire life. I'm like, do people work from like 10:30 to 4? I don't know. Like, what's this? Like, you got like a 3-hour lunch break, right? And then you just kind of dip back in. But like, I was so jealous of them because their brains were still connected to something.
Yeah.
Like, so when everything was taken away last year, you were saying I was like manic with this desire to like do stuff. I was like on the phone to my team, like, we got to do this, all these things. Yeah. And I made a lot of music, some good, some bad. I'm grateful for a lot of stuff. I had finished an album. I realized it wasn't right, so I got to change it. So there was a lot of great stuff in there. Mm. But fundamentally, the work just went from like, on my best day, 15% of what I was doing before, And that, so that sort of led, like I said to you, like we talked about it, I think we've talked about it on the radio, like a kind of a mental implosion where like all of these walls were just sort of like falling down and there's nothing you could do to avoid it, especially the start of this year.
Yeah.
When like last year there was a semblance of like, we're going to get back to normal, it'll be fine. And then January it was like, no, it's going to be even worse. And then that was the moment of like really reflection for me.
Yeah.
Where I was like, what am I doing? What, like, why am I trying to like force this work on myself? I need to just allow the walls to fall and just see what happens.
I cry in my car. I could cry when I want. All I have to do is just think about the day that you told me on my way sad. Now you like my look, but I talk too much. It's just the sky so damn beautiful. I feel like that deserves another look. I wasn't nervous, I wasn't angry. I was just so happy you were here at all. Fingers aching, chest wide open. And I feel like you saw me. Like I never could see myself.
But did you find any guilt with that? Like, I've seen, like, you know, on social media, people were, like, obviously going, I'm going to do all this. And then then the whole thing of, like, be okay with not doing anything.
Yeah. But, it's such nonsense. It's then, such yeah. nonsense. Like, everything has to be a message, right?
Yeah.
Like,
it has to be a hashtag.
It has to be something. Like, be okay with not being okay.
Yeah.
Your arse. Like, really, like, 100%. Like, that shit can... Fuck off. Like, that is so true. Yeah. There is, you can't ever do anything without it being sort of like Instagrammy and curated, right? Like, if you're imploding, it has to be an implosion that's front facing. That's for the people to witness. I have to go on, and I've done it. I've gone on Instagram and I've talked about these things as they're happening in real time and tried to be helpful and poetic and whatever. Well, fundamentally, it's all just curated. Like, it's not the real thing as it's happening in real time. Because if you gave that to the people, they'd be like, what the fuck? You know?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's the balance that you walk. Yeah. Like, you know, it's
Tara, I wanted to ask you about the pressures that come along with this. But before we get to that, like, how have you dealt with COVID and how has it affected your work and what you do?
It's, well, I haven't DJed in a long time, so that's gone. And I used to DJ maybe like 4 or 5 times a week, most, like, especially during summer and Christmas. But then I'd always be like, yeah, I'm only busy during the summer. And then I kind of just gradually just became like all year long in the last like 2 years, which I'm so grateful for. Again, I'm very much like, I pride myself on my time management and being able to like fit as many things as possible within one day. So, which isn't a good thing. So I'd even like be like, right, I'm going to go to London to go to and do like 3 meetings in the morning, but I'm going to come back and do my radio show in the evening. And I think that was like an amazing accomplishment. And I'd be there like in the airport, like just getting a flight to London, go to meetings like on Regent Street and then back in Dublin. And like I used to do that like all the time. And so look at this busy, fabulous life I have. But then I literally wasn't sleeping. So like that was the other thing. So there's obviously negative to that. But so I haven't DJed, obviously. Very, very grateful though that I've been able to still work in radio. So I've been doing my radio show. And I've actually been able to, you know, be able to, I mean, I've even had James on my show. I've been able to have guests that usually are too busy to come on the show, and I've been able to get them on the show. Yeah. So that's been a positive for the radio show. But I definitely do miss DJing a lot. And I bought decks, and I'd never actually owned decks for most of my DJ career, funnily enough. And then I bought some last year because I was obviously at home all the time. And I was like, do you know what? I'm just going to buy some decks and make loads of mixes. I've made one mix, like one. And my boyfriend's used them more than I have. And that's annoying because I just haven't been able to find the inspiration to do a mix. And I don't know, I just, and I've been working on mixes, I've been there, and then I start doing them, but I spend so long doing it that I get sick of it then, and then I'm like, start a new one, so I just haven't been able to finish one, and that, I still feel guilty for not having done that, because I'm like, it's been a year, you know, yeah. You should have had it, been able to do it.
And I was just going to say, do you, just because you mentioned guilt, and you work with a lot with promoting people and like helping their careers, and what, how do you deal with that pressure? Like, having, I suppose, people send you records to like dealing with the time to like listen to it, feel validated that your opinion means something. Mm. Like, how do you manage all that?
It's hard. I do manage it, but it's not easy. Like, because I don't have a team, so it's just me for my show. And so I listen to everything, I edit everything, I schedule my own things, which I know it's like, yeah, everyone schedules their entire time, but like, especially when I'm doing loads of other stuff as well, it's harder. But it's been easier because I haven't had loads of other bits and pieces to be doing. But no, it is tough because, well, it's not tough, sorry. I don't want to say that because I find my job like a dream. I really do. Like, I just get to listen to music and play music that I love and play artists that I'm passionate about and say, I love this song, you should listen to it. And I find so much joy in finding new music and new artists, and I have all my life. So this is genuinely a dream job for me. But I do find, I mean, I don't like to give an opinion on a record because I'm not a critic. I'm also, if I think it's a good song, I want people to hear it, and I think they think they should listen to it. Especially if people listen to my show, they'll usually have similar tastes to me, and they trust me then, they trust my opinion. But I don't like to give feedback on records because it's not my place to, because music is subjective. I might not like it, but someone else might. So, and I also, you know, the idea of me saying, I don't like this song, or I don't think this song is good, you know, that could, they could be like, right, I'm never making music ever again. And the idea of me being responsible for that, absolutely not. Yeah. So, you know, that's it. But they might find it a different show it might work for. It might just not work for my show. So, you know, there's a bit of a pressure because it is a big, big job. But, you know, I do really love it. You know?
But and how do you manage your... the spectacle of your performance, of you sitting, because I know, and we probably don't have enough time, but I'd love to hear about your the research and development before you even go on air, whether it's your own show or filling in other shows or doing anything. There's so much research, development, and then you're on, and then you have to become Tara Stewart, the broadcaster, and who is that person? How do you deal with that, I suppose?
When I first kind of started in radio, I felt like I was kind of performing on radio and would, especially if I'd be doing like daytime or, you know, filling in for the breakfast show on a weekend, I would be a more chirpy version of myself. But now I'm just literally myself. And I don't know if maybe that radio version has become me. Like, I don't know if maybe, you know, maybe I am that person like on air all the time. But I don't know. Maybe I have. Maybe everyone's like, please, she does need to calm down. Like, no. She's like this all the time. But I now am literally just myself on. So it's not like, my friends will tease me when I'm like, coming up after this or whatever, that kind of stuff. Obviously, I don't talk like that. Like, coming up right around the corner, I've got this next song. Yeah. I don't say that in normal sentences. So there are those things that, you know, are performance part of it. But I'm definitely just myself. So it's not, you know, even I remember this morning on radio.
But is it not, sorry to interrupt, is it not draining? Like, that's the thing, maybe it's not. Mm. Do you find, like, I know I did hear some broadcaster, wasn't it, that who was actually the most calmer when they were on air than off air or whatever. Mm. How do you find it? Do you?
I find it, my show is super chill. Like, and because I don't have loads of junctions, and there's not like news, there's not like loads of, you know, bits and pieces in there, right? It's just music, and that's literally it. There's news in every hour, but it's really chill. Whereas doing breakfast, that's a different game. Like, but you have a team, so it's actually grand. It's not that stressful because you literally have like two producers, and I have a co-host at the moment, Stephen Byrne. So you've got a lot of support there. So as much as it's a lot more intense, and you don't have time to scroll on your phone. Like, I was on Instagram this morning scrolling and I missed something. So you can't even be doing that. Yeah. Like, and I was like, oh my God, damn it. And just clicked a button.
Press a button.
Yeah, just press a button. And say I might click, like, you know, to go to an ad break. But then they'll be like, you weren't meant to play the ad break there, because that then has a knock-on effect. Yeah. So everything is timed to a T.
But do you know what? And we'll wrap up now in a second. But the last bit I wanted to talk about was and you mentioned it, is support. Having a supportive team around you or friends or peers, and I think that's what probably we all miss during the pandemic, yeah. is this social interaction. Is there anything, what are you looking forward to the most as the world reopens and that something positive that's going to happen to, I suppose, Irish culture and our lives?
I think we've learned not to take anything for granted anymore, especially if it is going for a pint with your friend or going to a gig. I will never, ever, ever take my job for granted again.
Perfect.
It's, if anything, it's actually just giving me a whole new love for it again. Because I think before the pandemic, it was just go, go, go. Then we're going to fly into 2020 and it's going to be an amazing year and all these amazing things are going to happen. And then it was just like, no.
Personally, probably just like definitely rekindled the love I have for painting. It got a bit too busy where at times it was a bit of a task and then they were like, oh no, why is it like this, you know? literally, yeah. So then it's given me time to just be more focused on painting and really enjoying it.
Yeah.
You know, so what I mean by that is painting back in a public space and that engagement there and giving it the time. During the lockdown last year, I was still able to paint some counties and my love for Ireland again. I was always going abroad and painting and then that engagement and realizing that the murals were actually just bookmarks to these social engagements and ownership of the space. Like I just learned so much of just painting and so I'll definitely carry that through.
Felicia?
I'm looking forward to adventure. Adventure in my writing, just because like we've been stuck in the same spaces and I feel like my creativity is screaming at me like, get out!
Oh my God, yes.
I can't wait to cook all. and just really go on an adventure and writing retreats like a little nerd, so yeah.
Brilliant. James? What are you looking forward to the most, Terry?
The most? I mean, from a selfish perspective, shows. Like, playing shows is going to be... Like, we went to Grouse Lodge for a week to do some rehearsals and some recording recently, and, it was the loveliest thing, because it was all, COVID-ed up. Everyone took multiple tests 3 days before we went, and on the day. So it was the closest thing to normalcy I've had in a year and a half. And it was, I can't describe it. It was, I've definitely taken stuff for granted. That happens. You let yourself off the hook for that stuff. We're going to get back into a life and it's going to be a switch will happen and we'll just get back into the same rhythm and we'll start taking stuff for granted. So there's no point in pretending that I'm going to walk into this new landscape with this sense of effervescent glow where I'm just going to everything is going to be, I'm going to succumb to those things that I succumbed to before, my work ethic, all these different things. But those moments in the studio where we were just looking at each other and we were making music better than we've ever played before and we were talking about building shows and I was like, I'm going to do exactly what I want to do, which I've never done before, which is ludicrous, that I've never actually done the thing the way I want to do it.
Yeah.
I've always aggregated for people around me or different wants or needs. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, fuck that. I'm just going to do exactly what I want to do. And that is really exciting to me because the possibilities are kind of they're endless. That's really just exciting to me.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
And Tara, what are you looking forward to the most?
The biggest thing I'm looking forward to is just hanging out with my friends again. I find, I'm especially when it comes to female times, your brain goes crazy for a week. And then I'm thinking I'm having this crisis. But usually you just talk it out with your friends. But I'm honestly just really looking forward to hanging out with my friends again because I am struggling not having that sounding board to talk to, really. So, I'm really looking forward to that.
Brilliant. Okay, so let me just say thank you so much for coming. I think we solved all the problems that we wanted to do.
World peace accomplished.
We probably need to do five versions of this. Yeah. Just us meeting back here. Best of luck with everything you're doing. And I think you're all wonderful. Not that that makes any difference.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we'll speak again sometime.
Okay.
Thank you.